I did a demonstration of protein synthesis using my cardboard ribosome, etc. And today I want to look at some of the details that we left out. In particular, we didn't talk very much about the ribosome. We said that you need a ribosome to hold everything together because the connection between the tRNA and the message is quite small. In fact, if this is a tRNA message combination, how many hydrogen bonds are holding it together? What is the max? It isn't three, it's three base pairs, and if they're GC, it's nine hydrogen bonds, and it could be as little as six. So this really isn't enough. So you need a ribosome to hold it together and increase the accuracy of this match. So what are the functions of a ribosome? Is to increase the accuracy of the base pairing between the codon and the anticodon. In addition, we need some catalyst to catalyze the formation of the peptide bond, such as here when one is connected to two, or here when two is connected to three. And the catalyst is part of the ribosome. So we need the ribosome for both of those, and we're going to talk today about the structure and function of ribosomes. Now, in addition, in order for things to work right, as we've said before, not only must the anticodon match the codon, but the amino acid must match the tRNA. So after we finish talking about ribosomes, we're going to talk a little bit more about tRNA, how you get the right amino acid on, and a little bit more about codon-anticodon pairing. And then we finish that, we're going to summarize about how RNA makes protein, and then if we have time, we'll talk about mutations. So let's think about ribosomes. What are ribosomes made out of? They're actually made out of two substances. They're not just RNA, and they're not just protein. They are a combination of RNA and protein. So a ribosome is what is called a ribonucleoprotein, or an RNP, or an RNP particle. So the RN stands for RNA, ribonucleo, and the P stands for protein. So this is a ribo-RNA protein complex, a ribonucleoprotein. And some people call it a ribonucleoprotein particle, because it's a thing. But the point is, it's neither just RNA nor just protein, but both. And the RNA part is what we call ribosomal RNA. And we'll go over in a minute what that's like and how it's all put together. But first we want to see what do these things do before we get mired in the fine points of structure. We want to do function first. Now, we already saw from looking at our ribosome, so to speak, what the important functional features of a ribosome are. It has two sites for loaded tRNA. That's why you can line up two at a time. And it has a groove for the messenger RNA. Now, all the ribosomes are the same in a cell. The ribosome does not determine what protein you are going to make. What does? It's the messenger that determines what protein you're going to make once you have ribosomes, a set of tRNAs, amino acids, and so forth. Now, there's one other feature of the ribosome, which we've implied, catalysis. The ribosome contains the enzyme, the catalyst for making the peptide bond. Now, what do you call this reaction? You're making a peptide bond, but in order to do it, you're going to break the connection here to the tRNA and transfer the peptide onto the amino acid, as we demonstrated last time. And therefore, this catalytic activity is called peptidyl C synthetase. No, excuse me, transferase. Peptidyl transferase instead of peptidyl synthetase or something like that, because it catalyzes the transfer of the peptide onto the amino acid. And this is actually a property of the ribosome. A part of the ribosome is responsible for this catalysis. Now, you may notice I've been very careful not to use the word enzyme, and the reason for that, as we'll see, is that it's the RNA and not the protein that is the catalyst. Now, in addition to everything that we've said, there's one other thing. So the ribosome has the two sites for loaded tRNA. It has the groove for the mRNA. It has the peptidyl transferase, and it also has a site for empty tRNA. So let's see how that works. Let's add a ribosome to this picture on your handout and see how it goes. The overall picture is that the ribosome travels down the message. Or, maybe more accurately, the ribosome stays put and the message travels through the ribosome. The net effect is the same, but the ribosome and the message move relative to each other. So originally, let's put our ribosome in. So our ribosome would look something like this. These would be the two sites or spots that hold the two tRNAs. And this would be the spot for empty tRNA, but we haven't gotten it yet. When the peptide bond is made, right after it's made, nothing has moved yet. But now, how does the ribosome know which way to go? These two sites are not equivalent. They are different, the two sites for loaded tRNA. And they are known respectively as the A and the P. And what that stands for is what's on the tRNA. It's much clearer if we draw it later, but if you look at it in step two. The one on the right holds a peptide on the tRNA. That's why, and the one here, let me say that again. The tRNA can have a peptide, or the tRNA can have an amino acid. Now, the P and the A sites, respectively, fit better with those two structures. The A site fits better with a tRNA and an amino acid, or I should say, a tRNA with an amino acid fits better in the A site, and a tRNA with a peptide fits better in the P site. So what happens when we get to step two? Everybody is in the wrong place. The empty tRNA is in a spot that ought to have a peptide. The tRNA with a peptide is where there ought to be a tRNA with an amino acid. So everything moves over one. This site here is called the E because it holds an empty tRNA, a tRNA with no amino acid. So relative to the ribosome, everything moves over one. You can think of the ribosome moving down away from the 5' end, or you can think of the message being pulled toward its 5' end. But the net result is the same, that the ribosome now looks like this. The tRNA, this tRNA here, is actually going to be bumped into the E site. So it would be, let me get my white chalk. It's drawn on your handout, but I didn't put it on the board. So the empty tRNA goes over here into the E site. The peptidyl tRNA moves over into its proper home, the P site. And now the A site is empty. And the next tRNA with an amino acid can come and fit in. And so in our next picture, it would look like this. Now, when the new tRNA comes in, that essentially bumps off the empty one. And so now we're ready to do it again. We have a peptidyl tRNA in the P site where it belongs, and an aminoacyl tRNA in the A site where it belongs. So what happens if we make a peptide bond? Peptidyl transferase comes into play, and we're going to connect the peptide to the amino acid, giving us step 5. But now, this tRNA is in the wrong place. In fact, everything is in the wrong place again. This tRNA is empty. It belongs in the E. This tRNA has a peptide. It belongs in a P. So everything moves over, opening the new one. Again, we would get this step. But now the empty one would be in here. The tRNA with the peptide would be in the P. And our A site is empty, ready for tRNA number 4. Which is going to come in, and that's going to bump out the empty tRNA. And the process just repeats until you get to the end. It is because the A and P sites are different and have different affinities for the different states of tRNA that the ribosome and message move in the right directions. Now, on your picture, it looks like the ribosome moves. We think in reality the message moves, and the ribosome stays in the right same place. So essentially, to go from step 2 to 3, what I do is really pull the message, this is step 3, but the 5 prime end, pull the message over one codon. And that will put, from 2 to 3, I pulled the message one codon, so that pushes these two, the tRNA and the message, move together into the P site. The empty tRNA is bumped into the E site, and now the next codon is pulled into the A site, and we're ready to roll again. Now, this process of moving the message relative to the ribosome, or the ribosome relative to the message, is called translocation, and it involves additional input of energy, which we've omitted. This just means moving. So in order to elongate the chain, you have to move the ribosome. Now, notice that protein synthesis uses up a lot of energy. It takes energy, as we will see, to get the amino acid on the tRNA in the first place. Then it takes energy to move the message relative to the ribosome. It's an expensive business. Therefore, there has been selection, especially among monocellular organisms, unicellular organisms, for efficiency and not making proteins you don't need. Because making proteins you don't need is a waste of energy and is a drag on growth. And next time, next week, we will discuss after the Election Day holiday, and you should all remember to go vote, we will discuss how protein synthesis is regulated so you don't make proteins you don't need. But for now, we'll stick to the basic process. Now, how many ribosomes are really on a message? We mentioned last time that ribosomes, when they're made, are not whole. They have two parts. And when you actually, and the two parts, which are relatively, one is bigger and one is smaller, they lie around, so you have a supply or pool of big ones. This is called the large subunit and the smaller subunit. Imaginative names here. And what happens is that they two come together to make one ribosome, which is sometimes written like this, to make it clear that it has two parts. So one ribosome attaches to the area where the appropriate AUG is. How that happens is a little different in prokaryotes and eukaryotes, but the ribosome assembles at the position of the appropriate AUG. But now, and we know from last time that when the ribosome gets to the end and stops making protein, it will come apart into its two subunits, and they will lie around until they are used again. But how many ribosomes are going to be on this message? It turns out the answer is many. That many ribosomes simultaneously translate this message. In fact, the average message is covered with ribosomes. Now, how does that work? You can think of it again as the ribosome moving down the message, or the message being pulled through the ribosome. So if we think of it from the message point of view, the message is being pulled through the ribosome as the tRNAs line up and you make peptide. So after a little while, there's some message sticking out on the 5' end. Now another pair of subunits can come together and fasten on. So this would be one, this would be two. Then as the message continues to be translated, we have even more room and we can add number three. Now as this process continues, eventually the first ribosome reaches here, here's the second ribosome, here's the third, the fourth, and the fifth, the whole message will be covered with ribosomes. So what happens is, as one ribosome falls off, there is room for another ribosome, falls off the 3' end, there is room for a new ribosome on the 5' end, and so in the steady state, the message is covered with ribosomes. Each of these ribosomes now has two tRNAs at a time on it and is making a growing peptide chain. But this, which ribosome has a longer chain on it? A longer peptide chain. Which ribosome has the longest peptide chain? It's going to be one, because number one has translated this section, this section, this section, this section, and is now doing this. Six has just gotten started. If you don't see this, you should convince yourself. And this structure is called a polyribosome, or a polysome for short. It's a messenger RNA covered with ribosomes, all doing their thing. Now, the net effect is the same if the ribosome moves down the message. But we'll just leave it this way. Now, I want to talk now about the actual parts of a ribosome, this small and large subunit, where's the RNA, where's the protein, etc. So before I do that, what questions do you have so far? Yes?
Are the ribosomes actually sort of right next to one another, or are they sort of spaced out?
Are the ribosomes right next to each other, or are they spaced out? As I understand it, they are right next to each other, but they are extremely large. So one ribosome covers more than two codons worth. The argument is that by having them relatively close to each other, the message is not exposed and is not easily degraded. So they're protecting the message as well as translating. There was a question over here.
Is there anything that holds the mRNA in that groove?
Is there anything that holds the mRNA in the groove? Well, remember how the groove forms, that the two ribosomal parts come and clamp onto the message. So they basically lock the message in.
Could you say it was like Van der Waals forces then, just because the process
is... Oh, is it Van der Waals forces? It's a combination of all the kinds of weak forces you know about, both ionic, hydrogen bonds, Van der Waals, etc. Yes?
When the empty tRNA is knocked off of, let's say, ribosome 1, does that go and pick up another amino acid and start back again?
So the question is, what happens to a tRNA when it loses its amino acid? It goes and gets loaded again by the appropriate enzymes with the right amino acid and can be reused. So tRNA is constantly reused. Yes?
So basically this process continues until all the protein synthesis that's needed, or all the peptide chains that are needed are produced, then it stops. So it's just sort of a continuous thing until it reaches the amount that's necessary.
Her question is, eventually, how long does this go on? This goes on either in some regulatory process stops new ribosomes from attaching, and that frees up the message, and the message is degraded. Or, I would say that's probably the answer, or it may be that simply messages wear out, they can only be read a certain number of times, and then they start to fall apart. In bacteria, messages have a fairly short half-life. They don't last that long. They last more like minutes. However, in eukaryotes, messages can last a long time or they can last a short time. It varies. So exactly what stops this process is, I think, a variable. But it doesn't go on forever. Okay, one more question, one or two more here, and then I think we're going to have to stop. Yeah?
How do the ribonucleases actually form?
How do ribonucleases, you mean ribosomes?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to get to that next. That's the next question is how you make a ribosome. Yeah?
Why don't the peptide chains on the center ribosomes, bond?
Why don't the chains that are coming out of here get stuck to each other? Remember, as a chain is made, it folds up upon itself. Largely because of its primary structure determines its 3D, but also remember that there are chaperones and chaperonins around here. So there, if it's very crowded, there will be other proteins shielding this peptide from this peptide from this one. One more, okay.
I guess I'm a bit confused why you would even need the ribosomes 4, 5, and 6 if one is essentially going.
Why isn't one ribosome enough? Well, the advantage of having a polysome is from one message, how many copies of the protein are we making simultaneously? In this picture, 6. Okay. So it means you get more protein per minute out of the same amount of stuff. So now the question is, a very good one, where do you get a ribosome from? How do you make ribosomes? So if you look at the bottom of the handout, to see which one it is. It's the one from today, 14A, if you look at the bottom. We have a diagram of a ribosome. So we've said a ribosome has these two parts stuck together, and actually if it was working, there'd be a message in the middle. And these are called the large and the small subunit, as we've said. The whole thing is one ribosome. Now, ribosomes and their subunits are enormous compared to proteins. They have molecular weights in the millions, while a respectable large protein, a protein that is 1,000 amino acids, is only a tenth of a million. So these things are huge. And when they were first discovered, nobody was really clear about what their molecular weight or their size was. What people knew was how fast they sedimented in a centrifuge. So these things are named after their S value, their Svedberg value, how fast they sediment in a centrifuge. So this is called a 70 or 80S ribosome. Now, there are always two numbers here. The smaller one is for prokaryotes. The larger number is for eukaryotes. We say that all living things and all cells work the same. They work approximately the same. But there are certain major differences between the setup in prokaryotes and eukaryotes. Everybody uses ribosomes. Everybody uses tRNA. Everybody has genetic material made of DNA. But there are small differences in the machinery. So this is a ribosome. And remember, we said it's a ribonucleoprotein. It's made of both RNA and protein, and its weight is somewhere between 2 and 4 million in Daltons. It's very large. It's very big. So it comes apart then into the large subunit and the small subunit when it's not being used. And each of these is also a ribonucleoprotein. Each of these has both RNA and protein in it, and each of these is also very large, over a million. And the big one is usually 50 to 60S, and the small one is 30 or 40S, depending whether you're talking eukaryotes or prokaryotes. Now, what's inside? You can take apart a large subunit, or a small subunit. The small subunit is easier, so we'll do that first. And it has one fairly large RNA inside, which is either 16 or 18S, depending on prokaryotes, eukaryotes. And this is an RNA. This is not an RNP, a ribonucleoprotein particle. This is plain old RNA. And this is what is known as ribosomal RNA. Now, as we'll see, there's some RNA in here. There's some RNA in the other subunit. All that RNA together is known as ribosomal RNA. But there are several sizes of ribosomal RNA, one in the small subunit and several in the big subunit. And this RNA is relatively large for an RNA. It's 3 to 5,000 nucleotides. No, not this one. This one is 1,500 to 2,000 nucleotides long. The big RNA in the other subunit, in the big subunit, is 23 or 28S, and it's the one that is 3 to 5,000 nucleotides long. Now, this is short compared to DNA, but this is long compared to transfer RNA. Transfer RNA is about 75 nucleotides. So for an RNA, this is on the large size. Now, so ribosomal RNA consists of the one large one in the small subunit, the large one in the big subunit, and then there are one or two small ones in the large subunit, which are written here as 5S RNA and 5.8S. Again, known by their S values. These are small. These are less than 200 nucleotides long, and this one is only in eukaryotes. So a working ribosome has anywhere between 3 and 4 different RNAs in it, and all those are collectively known as ribosomal RNA. But in a subunit, these RNAs are associated with a large number of proteins. You see in the large subunit, as it says on your handout, there are 34 to 45 different proteins. And in a big, small subunit, there are 21 to 33. So, what does it take to make a ribosomal subunit? The two subunits are made separately, and then they come together during protein synthesis to actually translate message. Now, we know that to make a protein, you make one or maybe several peptide chains, and each of them folds up, and then they stick together. And all of that folding is determined by their primary sequence. So what determines the shape, say, of a ribosomal subunit? It turns out that it is the primary sequence of the RNA and the protein that determines the folded shape of each part and the shape of the whole thing. And just as a single protein will fold up by itself in dilute solution, the end product determined by its primary sequence, so all of these pieces put together will fold into a unique shape, the working shape of a small subunit. It has been shown that in a test tube, you can mix all of these together. Now, you can't just throw them all in. You have to add them in the right order. But if you mix them all together in the right order, they will reassemble into a working 30S ribosomal subunit, and all of the pieces of a large subunit will reassemble into a working 50S ribosomal subunit. So what holds these things together or folded are the same forces that hold a protein together in three dimensions or a nucleic acid together in three dimensions. It's all those weak bonds together, which ones you have depending on the primary structure. Yes.
If you had proteins in the RNA with cysteine, would you have any sulfide bonds?
If there are cysteines in these proteins, do they form disulfide bonds? When they fold, some of them do and some of them don't, just like any other protein. Yes?
We need ribosomes to make proteins, but there are proteins in ribosomes. Where do we get those proteins from?
Uh-huh. This is the old chicken and the egg problem again. We say RNA makes protein, but the truth is to make protein, you need both RNA and protein. Now, the answer is that the only way you can get protein is from protein. That in this day and age, the only way you can get a cell is from another cell. There is no other way. We think that once upon a time, these pieces self-assembled. They were much cruder. They didn't work very well. And there has generally been selection for a better and better version. And today, the only way you can get a cell is from already having one.
So it just happened once.
You have to have a ribosome in order to make a ribosome, no question. But once upon a time, you probably didn't. Now, if you don't believe me, think about this. Can you make a computer without a computer? Would you like to be given the job in a business of making a computer without a computer? Heaven forbid. Did somebody make the first computer without a computer? You're damn straight they did, and they did it in my lifetime. Maybe not yours, but they did it in mine. But the point is that once you make the first crude one, it's so good that you can use it to design a better one, and then that one becomes a doorstop. And then you make a better one, and you keep going. And when you finally get to the end, you have this really sophisticated thing, and you don't have all the intermediate stages. And this is exactly analogous. So there's one more piece of this ribosome business. Remember we said that peptidyl transferase is actually part of the ribosome. So people have tested out the various parts of the ribosome, and it turns out that none of these proteins have that catalytic activity. It's actually the RNA in the large subunit which has catalytic activity. And it is, therefore, the catalyst, peptidyl transferase, is not made out of protein, it's made out of RNA. So instead of being called an enzyme, it's called a ribosome. Now this fits with this issue of how did all of this get started? Many people think that in the beginning, there was RNA. For years, the protein people and the DNA people argued it out. Proteins came first. Can't do anything out without proteins. What do you mean? Without information in DNA, you can't make more proteins. DNA came first. So finally somebody came up with a bright idea. No. RNA came first because RNA has both catalytic activity and information-carrying activity. And we will meet some other cases where RNA has catalytic activity, but this is probably the most famous. So now that we realize that RNA has some of the catalytic activity of proteins and some of the information-carrying ability of DNA, the idea is that very simple organisms in the beginning only had RNA. And over time, protein has taken over most of the catalytic jobs, and DNA has taken over the DNA storage job, and RNA has been left with the middleman jobs. So RNA still continues to do the messenger and the tRNA and so forth, and also a few catalytic jobs that are sort of left over that protein has not taken away. And this is one of them. Now, we have talked now about ribosomes as much really as I wanted to, and I think from the questions, we had a lot of questions, so I'm just going to go on and consider the question of how do you start protein synthesis and how do you stop it? How does this process written up here work? Well, let's consider the very beginning right here and consider starts first. The way we've drawn it, you have a ribosome that has an E site, a P site, and an A site, or APE. And you have the message. Except I shouldn't put it there. I should put it down here. And you have the message. So, this is the A site. It's supposed to hold a tRNA with an amino acid. No problem. When we very beginning, what goes here? This is supposed to have a tRNA with a peptide, right? There is no peptide when I get started. So what am I going to do? The answer is, there is a very special tRNA that fits in this spot. Only one. Remember we said that protein synthesis always starts with AUG. AUG doubles as the codon for methionine and the start codon. So in order to get started, there's going to be AUG here, and there's going to be a tRNA with the appropriate anticodon, and it's going to have methionine. Now, once we make the first peptide bond, the problem is no more. We have a peptide to put in the P site, a new amino acid to put in the A site, and we don't have any more problem. Except, suppose we are chugging along, and let's say this is codon 42, whatever it is. Here's our ribosome, and we have a peptide here. We've made a peptide, and our empty tRNA is over here. Do we ever have methionine in the middle of proteins? Well, we do. Methionine is not just found on the end. It's found in the middle. So methionine is supposed to come next. Well, can I use that tRNA? This tRNA, what's special about it, is it fits in the P site, and it doesn't fit in the A. So I can't use that tRNA. But the only codon for methionine is AUG. So that tells you that there are two different tRNAs that recognize AUG. Both of them have the same anticodon. C, what would be here? And here? Well, T if it were DNA, but this is RNA. You have to be you. So both of them have the same anticodon, but the rest of them is different. Different enough that when they fold up in three dimensions, T, cloverleaf, and then L, one of them fits comfortably in the P, and one fits comfortably in the A. If this is the one that fits in the A site, that's regular old tRNA methionine. And this is called tRNA mesh. And that's the one you'd put here. It's just like all other tRNAs. But the one that fits in the P site is special. And so it's called tRNA, the initiator tRNA, which means it holds methionine, but it's the special initiator. So you put an I, meaning this allows you to initiate or to start protein synthesis. And this is the only tRNA that fits in the P. So if that's true, what should all your peptide chains start with? Methionine, do they? Most of your proteins don't start with methionine. Now, the solution to that is when your proteins were first made, hot off the ribosome, they all started with methionine. For manufacturing purposes, all proteins are made starting with methionine. But then, sometimes the methionine and a few other amino acids are cut off. So the original protein has methionine, but then an enzyme comes along and cuts off one or a few amino acids, removing the methionine, and the protein starts with something else. This is an example of a very widespread business, which is usually called processing. Have we ever met any other case of this, where you make a macromolecule and then you use some enzymes to alter it a little bit? tRNA. Remember, transfer RNA has those funny bases? That comes from processing. The tRNA is made first. All it has is AUGC because of the template. And then some of those bases are altered by enzymes to make slightly different things. It turns out many macromolecules are processed or slightly altered by enzymes into their final shape. And we'll read more about this. This is much more extensive in eukaryotes than prokaryotes, and we'll talk about it a lot more next semester. But we will talk about it a little bit more later. Okay, so we know how protein synthesis starts. You find the first or the right AUG. The ribosome and the special tRNA get into position, and we can now go from here. How does protein synthesis end? And now maybe we'll just take the model because that might be the easiest way to show it. That when you have your ribosome and it's reading a message, and then you start with the first AUG, as we said, and you line up the right tRNA, which already has its amino acid on it, because tRNAs have to get loaded first, and how they get loaded is something we're going to talk about in a few minutes. And you put the second tRNA in, and then what we said is you make the peptide bond, and now you kick this tRNA, which is used, over into the E, and you pull the message, and that carries the tRNA with the peptide into the P. And now the A is empty, so we can put in the next tRNA. That, in fact, knocks off the empty tRNA. And then we can make the peptide bond, but now we do it again. So that was peptidyl transferase, capacity of the RNA in the ribosome. We move out to the E site with the tRNA, pull the message, and move the peptide along, etc. Well, suppose, I'm going to cheat, this was a stop codon. Remember, three of the codons in the code say stop. If this is a stop codon, why do I have to quit? I can't skip here. You can see that. You can't get over a gap. There is no tRNA for stop. There is a special tRNA for start, but there is no tRNA for stop. So if I come to a stop codon, I can't do anything. I can't keep going. There is a special protein that fits in when you come to a stop codon, and it causes the breakage of the peptide connection to the amino acid. This peptide would fold up and go do its job. The tRNAs would fall off. The ribosome would come to the end, come apart into its two subunits. But meanwhile, there'd be another ribosome here and another ribosome here and another ribosome here, and they'd be moving down. So the answer is that there is no tRNA for stop. Instead, there is a protein that fits in the ribosome and helps release the chain. So if this were a stop codon, there would be no tRNA to go here at all. Instead, the appropriate protein would fit in here, break off the bond, break off the growing chain would fold up, etc. tRNAs would come off, and ribosome would fall off the end. So are there any questions about the stopping and starting business? Yeah.
When the ribosome goes to slide off to the end, like what if it encounters another AUG, does it start?
What if it encounters another, if ribosome gets rid of that peptide and it comes to another AUG? In eukaryotes, generally, each message codes for only one protein and there are no AUGs in the end. However, in prokaryotes, as we will discover next time, sometimes you can have multiple proteins worth or multiple genes worth on a single messenger RNA. And then the ribosome probably can wiggle down to the next AUG and start over again. Yes?
What's so special about the P site that the start met?
What's so special about the P site is it has a slightly different 3D shape than the A site. So it probably is able to detect what is here. That there is a peptide bond here and not a loose amino.
With the methionine and the initiating methionine having the same codon, how are they distinguished as different?
Okay, so these two are the same when it comes to matching the codon and the anticodon. But remember, the ribosome is a big thing, and it's three-dimensional. So the ribosome has a hole or a site that's quite large. And this part is different in the two tRNAs. Yes?
How then does the amino acid tRNA that you have in the A site change to be able to fit in the G site if it couldn't fit in there in the first place?
Because once you make a peptide bond here, this part here has a peptide on it instead of amino. And so this is too big, so to speak, to fit on this side. It has to move over. Yeah?
How does the mRNA know when to stop?
How does the mRNA know when to stop? It doesn't. But what do you mean? Well, what determines when the protein synthesis stops? It's where the stop codon is. And that determines what the code in the DNA was. Now, it's worth mentioning that when we say starts and stops, the signal to start replication, the signal to start transcription, and the signal to start translation are all different. One is an origin, one is a promoter, and one is an AUG.
Are there other enzymes involved in bringing the correct tRNA into the A site?
Is there any special enzyme involved in putting the right tRNA into the A site? As far as I know, there isn't. It's a kinetic issue, that you have plenty of loaded tRNA and only this one sticks. Two more, and then we're going to have to go on. Yeah?
How many of the first amino acids get cut off by that enzyme?
How many of the first amino acids get cut off? It's variable. I don't know an exact number. It can be, I think, up to like 20.
And so there are different, there are like a few enzymes that do that for all these different amino acids?
The question is there a few proteases that take care of everything or a whole bunch of different ones? I think there are only a few, but I don't know for sure. Yeah?
So if there's only a promoter, if there's no promoter in the mRNA, then what signifies one AUG as the start versus another AUG down the line?
Okay, if there's no promoter, which there isn't, the question is, how does the cell know, how does the ribosome know which is the right AUG? In eukaryotes, it's basically the first one. In prokaryotes, it depends on the sequence surrounding the AUG. Okay? So, at this point, I want to ask, how many tRNAs, different kinds of tRNA, do you need to make a protein? What is the obvious number? 64. Any other obvious numbers? 20. The two obvious numbers are 20 and 64. Well, the real answer is about 30. So the question is, how do you get 30? So part of the answer is, three of those codons are stop codons. They don't have tRNAs. But on the other hand, because of the initiation business, we have an extra tRNA. But that still leaves us with about 60. So how does the number get down to 30? One way of asking that question is to consider something we just talked about. That's all right. I don't need it anyway. I hope. Where did I put my eraser? Anybody see it? Oh, thank you. This works much better than the regular erasers. Okay. We have just said that for one codon, in the case of methionine, you can have two different tRNAs. You have, let's say, the initiator tRNA met, and you have the regular tRNA met. So we could call them one and two. You have two tRNAs for one codon. Can it be the other way around? Can you have two codons? Well, we'll call it codon 1 and codon 2, but only one tRNA. Well, do you have a copy of the genetic code? I think it's on the back of 13B. This will work only if you have synonymous codons. If both of these codons signify the same amino acid, then we could use the same tRNA without messing anything up. Do you ever have two codons for the same amino acid? Well, you certainly do, because there are 61 codons that code for something and only 20 amino acids. There are few amino acids for which there is only one codon, such as methionine. But for most cases, there are at least two and sometimes as many as six, which is in the middle. That line in the middle shows you how many codons for each amino acid. So So, for example, UUU and UUC code for the same amino acid. And if you look at your chart, in fact, you will see whatever, whatever U and whatever, whatever C is always the same. It doesn't matter if you switch U for C in the three position, you always get the same amino acid. Now, this means there are synonyms in the genetic code. There's at least two ways of saying phenylalanine. You can say UUU, UUC, it means the same thing. Does this mean that the genetic code is ambiguous? I hear this word all the time with respect to exam questions. This question is ambiguous. Is the genetic code ambiguous? We're not discussing my exam. Is the genetic code ambiguous?
No.
You always know what it means. But it does have synonyms. Like I'm here and I'm present. There's two ways of saying it. Any code where there's more than one way of saying something is said to be degenerate. This is not a moral value. This just means that there's more than one, there are synonyms for the same thing. The genetic code is not ambiguous, but it is degenerate. So one can take advantage of this degeneracy to use the same tRNA to read UUU and UUC, and that just saves on tRNAs and it doesn't mess anything up. Now, how is that possible? That's on the handout for today, on the top. So if you look at the right here, we've drawn a standard tRNA, the way we usually write it, with the 3 prime here and the 5 prime, so it's anti-parallel to the message. So here's the codon and the anticodon. So let's say this is UUC in the message. What would we expect in the tRNA? Well, opposite C, we'd expect G, but since this is 5 to 3, we're going to write it upside down. And opposite U, A, and opposite U, A. So with the anticodon AAG, read 3 prime to 5 prime, for the codon, UUC. And so what amino acid would we expect here? Excuse me? Do you look up AAG or UUC? You look up UUC. Which is phenylalanine, I think, right? Yeah. So this would be phenylalanine. Now, you can number the positions in the codon in the usual way, 1, 2, 3. Now, in the anticodon, strictly speaking, depending which way you count. But the way we look at it, it's really 1. If you count from the 5 prime end, it's the 1 here. So it's these two. We're going to allow these two to so-called wobble or cheat. These two don't have to pair perfectly. Now, when you look at the code, most of the degeneracy is position 3 of the codon. UUC and UUU code for the same thing. UUA and UAG code for the same thing. CU anything codes for the same thing. Most degeneracy is in the third position. Now, when we have a regular hybridization or pairing up between two nucleic acids, they're both straight, and the pairing has to be the standard A with U or T, G with C. But in this case, one of our RNAs is bent. So these two, this pair, are not exactly opposite each other. So in addition to being exactly like this and allowing A and U and G with C, they can twist a little. And therefore, uncanonical base pairs are allowed. You can't pair anything with anything, but you can do more pairs than just A with U and G with C. And that phenomenon is called wobble, because literally it's wobbling a little, and we're allowing a little cheating. So, for example, if you look at the picture underneath, we have now the degenerate codon U, U, U. But we have exactly the same tRNA, GAA. Now, normally, G and U cannot pair. They can't form hydrogen bonds. But because the G and the U can wiggle a little relative to each other, you can pair G with U in this position. And this is called also the wobble position, which corresponds to the 3 position in the codon and the 1 position in the anticodon, counting from the 5 prime end. Now, these little pictures on your handout show you how these unusual base pairings work. Now, the one on the left top shows you a CG pair of the standard kind, and then it says that's a uracil adenine pair. Is that a uracil adenine pair? Well, I got this right out of a textbook, but it isn't. It's a thymine adenine pair. So the very top one on the left is CG, and the next one is actually TA, not UA. But you notice how the pair looks. Here's the adenine down here. This is your standard thing. So you have a double bond O here and an NH. Now, in this picture, there are bonds to the sugar that look sort of like this. And they don't Xerox very well. So if you see these sort of strange marks, that's what they are. That's to the sugar. Now, where do the hydrogen bonds go? If this is adenine, it's NHH. And there's an N here, double bond. So the idea is you have a hydrogen bond and a hydrogen bond. Now, the book made a mistake and called this uracil when it's really T. Why doesn't it make any difference? Because the hydrogen bonding is exactly the same. The difference is what's here. If it's an H, it's uracil, and if it's a methyl, it's T, and you notice it's a methyl. But it doesn't make any difference. The hydrogen bonding is the same. Now, how can you possibly pair with G? If you look at the picture underneath, you see that the U looks essentially the same, except this time it really is U, because it has an H here instead of a methyl. And now they have the G. But the big difference is, over here, you notice that this double bond O went to this amino. But now, this double bond O on the G can't go opposite this double bond O. That won't work. So instead, it's the NH here that does the hydrogen bonds. Basically, what we've done with the G is to move it down one, so that it hydrogen bonds to, instead of the A bonds to the top 2 available spots, the G hydrogen bonds to the bottom 2 available spots. And you can see that from the pictures here. So a UG pair is allowed if the G can swivel a little this way, or the U can swivel a little up. And that's what's happening. Now, the little table on top tells you what's allowed in the wobble business. You can't pair everything with everything. You can twist some of them around to doomsday, and it won't work. Now, there's a similar table in your notes, which is a little different. The thing to realize is, which is the tRNA, and which is the message? You notice in your table that there's only one base listed for the tRNA. But the question is, how many bases in the message will go with this G? And if you look at your little table, you see the G goes with C or U. So this G can go with U. This G can go with C. Now, so we see that GAA works, or AAG, depending on how you read it. This anticodon works to read both codons for phenylalanine. What is the anticodon in tRNA for the leucine codons. Remember we said UUU and UUC were phenylalanine. But UUA and UUG are leucine. What tRNA could pair with both of them and not mess up the code? So I want you to discuss that for a minute. See if we can you can figure it out. What's the right corresponding tRNA? Can you find one that will do both? And you need your little tables. To go here? A, no wobble, no funny business. But is there something that can pair with both A and G? And that's U. So as long as this is U, we are okay. Now could it be I? I is a modified base. I is A without its amino. It has a double bond O instead. And you notice that I can pair with U, C, or A. Could we use I here? I doesn't pair with G, so forget it. Could we use I here? It pairs with both U and C. What else does I pair with? So it would read UUC, UUU, and UUA as the same amino acid. Is that okay? No, it isn't. So you can't use every tRNA that fits the wobble rules. The tRNA has to fit the wobble rules of what's allowed, and it has to not mess up the code. It has to fit with the codon assignments so that you don't get ambiguity and you don't mess things up. So in this case, for one, you have to have a tRNA that reads U and C but not A and G. And for this one, you want a tRNA that reads A and G in the message, but not U and C. And then you're okay. So having said all of this, how many tRNAs do you really need? The reason you need about 30 is that usually one tRNA can read a pair of codons. Some tRNAs can read three, some can read only one, and some can read two. On the average, it's about one tRNA for two codons, so you end up with about 30 instead of about 60. Now, the thing we didn't discuss here is how do you get the amino acid on the tRNA in the first place? And that's the other side of your handout. And that's what I want to talk about next. Now, this picture should look vaguely familiar. You have never seen this picture before. But this picture is very similar to one I drew when we were trying to make polynucleotides. We had the same sort of uphill-downhill business. We said that to just add on a monomer was uphill, but so we had to couple making monomers, linking monomers to breaking ATP. And this is a similar deal. So if we start with an amino acid and a chain, which is N long, and we make a chain which is N plus 1, that's uphill. So we're going to have to blow some ATP to do this. And the way you do it is you put the amino acid on a tRNA. So I'll just do that arbitrarily. And the chain is also on a tRNA. as we will explain, it took some ATP to get these things on the chain, on the tRNAs. That's where the ATP came in. And these are actually high-energy bones. Now, as you might expect, to make a high-energy bond, how many do you think you had to blow?
Two.
But we'll come back to how you do it. But once you got this far, now if you break one of these, you can grow the chain, and it's downhill. But the question is, which one are you going to break? Well, let's look at our picture up there. I can't pull it down because I can't reach it. But if you look at step four, you have a peptide on a tRNA and an amino acid. Which connection do you break to grow the chain? You break the peptide. So what we're going to do is break this bond and stick the the carboxyl end of this one onto the amino end of this one, which is exactly what we did up there. So if we had, this was 4, and this was 1, 2, 3, what we're going to do is we're going to add 1, 2, 3 onto 4. So which tRNA? This is going to be attached to a tRNA. So which tRNA are we going to lose? The left one or the right one? We're actually going to lose this tRNA. We're going to put this chain on the end, and this is going to be which tRNA? 1, 2, 3, or 4? This is going to be 4. Now, in your notes, there's a real example. This is histidine tRNA, and this one is metgly-L. And to be sure you know what you're doing, you should try, without looking at the answer, which tRNA is this, which tRNA is this, which one is this, and which one is this. And if you can figure that out, you understand what's going on. But where does the ATP come from? It's pretty obvious that we're going to have to put some tRNA in here. We're just considering now this part. Clearly, if each amino acid is on its tRNA, the chain will be 2. So the issue is, how do you get an individual amino acid onto its tRNA? So clearly, as shown here, you're going to have to put in some tRNA. You're going to take the amino acid and the tRNA and make aminoacyl tRNA. So if I write that again as a reaction, amino acid plus tRNA goes to aminoacyl tRNA. And we'd have to put in water to balance it, but I'm leaving it out for now. Uphill, downhill? Uphill, delta G, positive. So what do I have to couple it to? I have to break down some ATP. Now, how am I going to do it? I'm going to have to lose 2 phosphates. Now, I could take 2 ATP and knock a phosphate off each one. But instead, I take 1 ATP and I knock off 2 phosphates. So I break 2 high-energy bonds and I make 1. And the only catch is that this is really 2 steps. What I really do is I break the ATP into AMP plus pyrophosphate. How many high-energy bonds did I break to do this? 1. So why am I talking about 2? Remember pyrophosphatase? Pyrophosphatase is there. It doesn't care where the pyrophosphate came from. It will quickly break the pyrophosphate into 2-PI. So as long as I have pyrophosphatase and the enzyme to put another enzyme, I will end up here. So what I've really said is I have to couple these two reactions. And that requires an enzyme. It actually requires a set of enzymes, one for each amino acid cognate tRNA pair. So to put methionine on the right tRNA, I need methionyl tRNA synthase. To put histidine on the right tRNA, I need histidyl tRNA synthase. And the enzyme, actually, each one of those enzymes does it the same way. So let's write it very briefly. These, if you look down at the bottom, we just did reactions 1 and 2 plus pyrophosphatase. And now we're going to do reactions A and B. On the surface of the same enzyme, you have two steps. The first one is that the amino acid plus ATP, and now we split the ATP, and we have aminoacyl AMP. Then the amino in step B, the aminoacyl AMP on the surface of the same enzyme transfers the amino acid to tRNA. So the amino acid goes onto the tRNA, and now you're left with AMP. And I should have put pyrophosphate here. And if we throw in pyrophosphatase, we've net broken two high-energy bonds, and we've made one. Now, let me just say a few more things about this to wrap it up. This looks like a pretty complicated business, but it does serve actually two functions. Getting the amino acid on the tRNA, or coupling these two reactions, provides the energy to drive protein synthesis. So the loading enzyme does that, the synthase. In addition, you better match up the amino acid in the tRNA right, or protein synthesis won't be accurate. And this enzyme checks twice. This is another case of measure twice, cut once. Because the amino acid has to fit right in the first step, and then the amino acid and the cognate tRNA have to fit right in the second step. This business of using two steps that checks the same amino acid twice increases the specificity of the enzyme considerably so that the number of mistakes is quite low. It's not zero, but it's low. Now, the only other thing I want to say about this is that the enzymes that catalyze this have a very large number of different names. Suppose this is histidine. We would talk about histidine tRNA synthase or synthetase. We would talk about histidine tRNA loading enzyme and charging enzyme and activating enzyme. So these are called charging enzymes, loading enzymes, activating enzymes, and synthases or synthetases. Now, that reflects in a way how many different important things these enzymes are doing. These enzymes are serving the function of loading up the tRNA with the right amino acid. That's why they're called loading enzymes. They get you a high-energy form of the amino acid ready to rip, ready to go downhill. That's why they're called activating enzymes. They're also called charging enzymes, which means the same thing or both. And finally, they're called aminoacyl tRNA synthases or synthetases to make it clear that they match up the two halves properly. They synthesize the right combination. And that's the specificity part. And so these enzymes are a very important part of the deal. Now, there are two things we did not discuss. One is a sort of summary of how you put it all together, and the second is the issue of mutations. So we will start next time by doing a brief summary and then talking about mutations. It refers to recitation problems 8. They may be 7, they may be 8 in your notes.